Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we talk film with A.O. Scott, the chief film critic for the New York Times. Tony Scott joined the Times in 2000 after a number of years as a literary critic. He was a Sunday book reviewer for Newsday and was also a frequent contributor to Slate and other publications. He's also served on the editorial staff of the New York Review of Books and Lingua Franca. Since joining the Times, though, his criticism has been focused on film. Over the course of a year, Scott will review anywhere between 2 to 5 films a week, from the biggest Hollywood blockbusters to small independent films and foreign films, documentaries, and animation. He'll be the guest of Congregation B'nai Emunah's Talking Heads series event tonight at 7 o'clock at the synagogue, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Tony Scott, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about where film is today, because anytime Hollywood brings out 3D, you know things are sort of in trouble. You know, 3D started in the 1950s when television caught on. There was another little spate in about the end of the 60s and 70s when the studios were crumbling. And we see 3D today.
Yeah, and it is partly, I think you're quite right, a sign of panic or of anxiety that the people who have been going to the movies are going to stop and are going to do something else. And first, it was television in the 50s. And then, you know, in the 80s, there was VCRs and home taping was going to destroy the movie business. And now, of course, it's the internet. And part of what 3D has been an attempt to create a big spectacle that you can't get at home, that'll bring people out. The thing is, people are still going to the movies, and I think that there still is an appeal to leaving the house. And part of what the economics of 3D was, I think, was to help the transition to digital. The Hollywood studios are very committed to digital production and to digital exhibition, which costs a lot of money on the front end, but saves them. They don't have to, you know, you don't have to strike 2,000 prints of a movie. You just copy the information onto drives and send them out. They wanted the theater chains to retrofit as quickly as possible and to update to digital. And one of the ways they did this was with 3D, which can only be projected digitally. And they invited the theater owners to charge whatever premium they wanted for 3D, which the exhibitors got to keep, that paid for this equipment that the studios are demanding that they put in. So that's part of what 3D is, part of this very big, very profound shift that's going on that in some ways is as big as consequential as the introduction of sound at the end of the 20s, which is the transition from, you know, what they call photochemical or what we think of as film to this other thing.
Now, I have to ask you as a critic, you know, I remember when the audiophile revolution happened in the 80s, you know, you had all these audiophiles as I can hear the difference between a record and a CD, and they would explain why an LP with more limited dynamic range sounded better than a CD. Is there anything going along that line among film critics?
Very much so. There are celluloid purists. There are 35-millimeter fanatics who say that. And it has to do with the grain. The emulsion on the film and the light passing through that creates a richness of texture.
And a warmth.
And a warmth and a tonal range. You know, so you can see in a black and white film, you know, the grays and the silvers. There are more precise shadings. It used to be possible, much more possible, you know, to sit down in a movie theater and look at something, a new movie, and identify the format. It's getting harder and harder. Technology has advanced, you know, in the last 10 years, and certainly in the time I've been a film critic, the digital technology has just its capacity and its precision has just grown enormously.
And in fact, you can put a process on a digital film and make it look any way you want.
Well, and most movies, and there are some filmmakers who still are very attached to Christopher Nolan, for example, and Steven Spielberg. But of course, what a lot of the effects that they're using are digital effects that are then processed onto film. So it's fascinating. There's a big argument going on now among critics, and also in the restoration community, because a lot of the revival houses and a lot of the restoration that's being done now is being done digitally. And there's a question of, you know, whether there's some loss of quality and integrity and authenticity when you take these celluloid artifacts and transfer them to digital. Again, though, the tools that you're using to restore are more and more digital tools. tools.
Let me ask you, as a critic and film buff, do you buy into the idea that you're losing something digitally as opposed to film?
Well, I think artists will always use the available means and the available technology, and I don't think it's ever possible to slow down or to stop, much as we might wish for it, you know, that everything, you know, none of us wants to grow older. We don't like to see the things we love turning obsolete, and you know, there are certainly critics who look back on whatever the glory days, you know, the indie boom of the
Which
90s or the 70s or
five,
the studio
top 5 to 10 years before you started.
Right. Or whenever the person talking was in their 20s, you know, and going out to the movies and falling in love for the first time
right.
and having their minds blown by whatever was going on. But that's always very subjective. And I think that creative people will always take advantage of the tools that they have. And so I think that the aesthetics are still being defined, and it's true that you can do things digitally. There are movies like, say, the Harry Potter movies, some of which I think are wonderful movies, that couldn't really have been made pre-digital, just in terms of the effects. And I think we're also seeing, you know, a real boom in animation. Also just the, for many people, the kind of the democratization of access to filmmaking equipment. It's a lot easier. You can go out with a pretty good consumer-grade high-def camera. You can edit the movie on your laptop. I mean, it's not going to be a Spielberg movie, but, you know, a lot of people...
You can tell a story.
You can tell a story, and you can, you know, go out into your community and find out what's going on.
So I don't think I'm going to get an answer from you, whether you like film.
I love the look of film, and I love old movies. And I love watching old movies projected on good prints, But again, you know, for everyone who complains about how digital is sort of ruining it or it isn't as good when you see it, you know, projected on DCP, I grew up seeing old movies on really bad prints, you know, in college on just totally scratched up, chewed up 16-millimeter prints where, you
Burn
know, the
marks,
bulb would get
yeah.
hot and melt the film. So... Or you know, it would be faded. It would be different colors at different times. And now, you know, if you have a decently transferred DVD, or you know, if you're in a revival house looking at a DCP, you're going to see something that's better than what you would have seen. So without being either a kind of a techno utopian or you know a kind of sky is falling, everything's going to hell declinist, I think that a lot is improving. I mean, there are more movies now from the history of movies available to more people than has ever been true before. It's easier to see, to have access to, and to experience and to think about more great movies from the past than it ever has been before. And that can't be a bad thing.
Let's go back to that beginning question. We were talking about the sort of panic that Hollywood is having about the internet and the fact that there's Netflix, there's Redbox, there's everything that will keep you from going to the theater to spend a little more money for a film experience. Is there anything to that threat? I mean, I think people are always going to go to movies. They might be a little more selective.
I think so. I think that people will keep going to movies because it is a unique kind of experience. It's just different. And you can go, it's both a more social experience because you can go with a bunch of your friends or on a date and, you know, talk about the movie afterwards and make a night of it. And it's also, in a way, a more intense solitary experience because you're sitting there in the dark. You have this sort of immersive screen up ahead of you. So I think people will continue to go, and people have been continuing. I mean, the audience numbers of tickets sold sort of dip a little bit and rise a little bit, but have not collapsed in the last few years. There's also been some attempts to improve the movie-going experience, not just with kind of the big, splashy, gimmicky technological things like 3D, but in a lot of cities, making nicer theaters, having better food.
Glass of wine.
You're right. You could get a glass of wine. There are, you know, in some cities, I know at Los Angeles, at Arclight now, they have, you know, a theater where it's reserve seating, and some shows are just for 21 and over, so there aren't going to be kids screaming and running around, and you can have a beer or a glass of wine and watch the movie with your fellow grown-ups. So I don't think that movie-going is dying. I think that movies are, as they have been in every decade of their short existence, it's changing. you know, in the 1930s, that was the high point of movie attendance because there was nothing, you know, there were movies and there was radio. There wasn't television. There wasn't the internet. So people went 4 or 5 times a week, which was great. But it's not as if that's ever going to come back. Right. And
I think every media is going through that as a person in radio. I mean, we've been predicted we're going to die.
I work for a print newspaper, so I'm hanging on by my fingernails and trying to figure out how to keep the thing going.
My guest today is A.O. Scott, chief film critic of the New York Times. Tony Scott is my guest. He will be the guest of Congregation B'nai Emunah's Talking Heads tonight at 7 o'clock. He'll be answering all sorts of questions about film, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. There's always been two levels of films. There have been serious films, and then there have been films. At one point, they were B-movies. Now, to me, B-movies are the films that are sort of designed for the first weekend gross.
Yeah.
And there seems to be these two categories. Given what, you know, the fears about the internet and all that, is there any sense that one is going to predominate?
It's interesting because one answer to that question for the last few years has been that the Hollywood studios are much more heavily invested in what used to be the B-movies, you know, the sort of the cheap entertainment for the masses, for kids, and genre movies. And in the very expensive form of these huge action franchises.
The comic franchises.
The superhero franchises and, you know, the
Twilight.
Family animation . And these make huge amounts of money, and they're also they do very well globally. And now the movie studios are more and more in kind of a global business, so they're looking for an audience worldwide and for very big numbers, not just domestically, but everywhere. And so that means, you know, action is a kind of universal language, comedy less so. So you get these very big and grand and elaborate and narratively simple stories coming out. And that's where a lot of the money is going and how a lot of the money is coming back. And, you know, even a couple of years ago, I would have said, you know, then there are the sort of the smaller scale movies, the independent movies, and the middle, the sort of middle-sized movies that have been more serious, more ambitious, the kind of the, what used to be called the prestige pictures, that those have been in decline.
Or given actor salaries today,
right,
can be the dream project, you know, a lot of times.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's funny, if you look at the past year, at the Oscars last year, that story got complicated a little bit. I mean, that a lot of critics who had sort of taken this as, okay, this is the way things are. You have the indies, you know, the smaller scale movies getting smaller and smaller, and that's where the quality is and that's where the ambition is, and they're tending to find a smaller audience. And then you have the big blockbusters and franchise movies and serials, the Harry Potter movies, the Twilight movies, the Avengers, Marvel movies. But then last year was a little different. I mean, you had a bunch of movies. You had 7 out of the 9 Best Picture nominees that grossed more than $100 million domestically, none of which was a superhero movie, many of which were quite, you had Lincoln, which is a 2.5 hour long kind of history lesson. I say that with love, but you know, it's about getting a bill through Congress and a bunch of guys with big beards and dark suits, and that made a ton of money. Django made a ton of money. Flight, Life of Pi, all of these coming, you know, kind of being the kind of movies that were supposed to be obsolete. The sort of the fairly expensive. These were not low budget movies. These were not little indies. They were mostly made with the backing of and distributed by the major studios. And they were, whatever you think of the individual merits of a given picture, were all ambitious and serious and trying to tell an interesting and in many cases unconventional story in a way that would appeal to a very big audience. So it upended a little bit the kind of the gloomy conventional wisdom that a lot of us critics have been attached to for the last few years.
By my count, of the 9 or 10 films that were nominated for Best Picture, I thought probably six of the 10 in a given year could have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
I mean, Argo won.
Yeah, yeah.
But Lincoln, in many years, that sort of historical epic drama would win. Zero Dark 30, you know, that same film, but a different film won 2 years ago with The Hurt Locker. And Silver Linings Playbook is that sort of Dark Horse.
Yeah.
Film, Life of Pi. Probably Les Mis was probably the most conventional film of the lot, which in many other years probably would have won.
Well, it was a big musical, extremely popular with a very passionate, you know, and devoted audience, people who loved the show, loved the movies, a very talented cast, and a very old-fashioned kind of grand, you know, emotionally engaging spectacle. But you're quite right. All of those, you know, any one of those movies in a given year, you would say, well, that was good. And to have all of those kind of coming out in the same year was
terrific. 1939, but it might be close.
No, but it's pretty good. And you know, if you look back over the last few years, they're always enough. I mean, you know, I'm always surprised at the end of the year. Like, what happens is there's this release schedule that skews it a little bit. So in, you know, April, May, June.
This time of year. You're going, oh, man, there's nothing coming out.
And right. And you know, some of us sometimes write apocalyptic think pieces about, you know, that's the death of cinema. It's all over. You know, it's ruined. This great art form has been completely trashed and corrupted. And then, you know, by December, the golden age of cinema is back. and we have, there are too many movies that to keep track of.
Well, to give a sense, I was looking at your recent picks, and yeah. I think there's like three or four documentaries. There's a couple of foreign films, right. And maybe one domestic film that's on the pick list.
Yeah, that tends to happen in the early months of the year. That, you know, some of the foreign language Oscar nominees come out, a lot of documentaries come out, some of the smaller indies, and then the studios release like Olympus Has Fallen or Identity Thief, or you know, these sort of. And then, the summer starts, I guess, in a couple weeks, the official summer blockbuster movie season.
Now, summer films make a lot of money usually. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big hits.
Yeah.
But they usually don't do much with the critics. I mean, they tend to be a little formulaic. Mm-hmm. Can you think of a summer movie that you really, really loved over the last couple of years?
I've loved some of the Pixar movies, which tend to come out in the summer.
WALL-E is one of your favorite movies.
WALL-E is one of my – and Toy
it was
Story
the top,
3.
It was the top – film of 2000s, of I think. You, there was some list that you did where it was the top film of the decade.
Of the decade, and I think that's just a wonderful movie. And and there are others. I mean, I like some of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, and I have, I mean, even though I got in a big fight on Twitter with Samuel L. Jackson about The Avengers, I didn't think it was such a bad movie.
It was worth spending 2 hours in the dark, probably.
Sure, it was fun. It was exactly what it was meant to be. I mean, I was holding it to too high a standard, but but on the other hand, you know, I think entertainment too. Entertaining movies should be as good as they can be. I don't think that we should ever, sell our pleasures short.
Tell me about getting into a Twitter fight with Samuel L. Jackson. I mean, I can't imagine getting any sort of real altercation with Samuel L. Jackson. I think I would just go into a puddle. But even Twitter is probably a little intimidating.
It was one of these bizarre, you know, digital media things that happened. Where I guess when my review came out, he sent out a tweet, not at me. I guess you would call that a subtweet. Saying, you know, let's find A.O. Scott a new job, what he can actually do. And so all of a sudden, I hadn't seen that original tweet. And then all of a sudden, my own, you know, modest little Twitter stream was filled up with Avengers fans, you know, calling me all kinds of terrible names. I thought, what, you know, what have I done? What's going on? And then it sort of got picked up. I responded something. I don't even remember what my response was. One of the things I tweeted was something my son said, you know, which is why does Mace Windu hate us so much? Why does he want to take the food off our table? So it became one of these little kind of teapot tempests. And he was making, in a way, I think, a kind of interesting point, which comes up a lot when you're a critic, which is, you know, who the heck are you? Why are you trying to ruin everybody's fun? Why do you have to take shots at this movie that everyone's going to have a good time seeing? Which is in a way fair enough, although I don't see why it ruins anyone else's good time if I politely point out some of the shortcomings of this.
You know, we talked about all this technological change. Critics may be 30 years ago could close a show, could destroy a film. Yeah. I don't think any critic could do anything to anything. I mean, I mean, it's an interesting point of view.
Yeah.
It might inform a decision somewhat, but I think most people take every sort of critical opinion with a grain of salt today.
Well, I think that's healthy. Or take it as what it is, which is an opinion, an argument, a point of view, not an authoritative statement or judgment. And I think that there are more critical voices out there, which I think is extremely healthy. And I don't think that power is concentrated in quite the way it used to be in some, you know, critics at big city dailies or important glossy magazines who can kind of issue these sort of ex cathedra judgments. And I think that's good because I've never thought of my own position as a critic as one, you know, as bossing people around and telling them what to do. I mean, I'm trying to persuade them of my point of view. I'm trying to, I tend to think that I'm right, but not in a, you know, not in a coercive way. I think also that critics can help a lot. I mean, it's certainly true that a movie like The Avengers or any other big blockbuster movie has been, its opening and its presentation to the public has been engineered in such a way that doesn't matter what critics say. It is sort of a huge kind of tidal wave of hype is coming and is carrying people into the theaters in the first weekend or a couple of weekends, and whatever the reviews in the Friday morning paper say is not going to make much of a difference. But I think when you have smaller films, independent films, films that might need a little help, might need a push, might need someone, you know, catching the attention of the public and saying, hey, this one here may not have the advertising budget, you may not have heard as much about it, but you might want to check it out. I think there is a sometimes dramatic effect that critics, maybe not a single individual critic, but, you know, a chorus of critics can do. I mean, I think that happened last year with Beasts of the Southern Wild, a movie that came out of the Sundance Film Festival. And
made largely by amateurs and local residents.
First-time film, all non-professional cast. Made in the bayous of Louisiana for very little money and a great deal of commitment and heart. And commitment and heart, you know, don't necessarily make a good movie. A lot of skill and and artistry and two extraordinary performances by Kwavanchene Wallace and Dwight Henry as Hush Puppy and her dad. But that, I think, was helped a lot by critics, and I think it's a very good feeling when you think, okay, you know, something that that you've written or that you've said has helped find an audience for something that deserves it.
I'm going to go back again to that big question of technology, and this gets this idea of, you know, does this technology help us find these films? I think, just in my own personal experience, I've found all sorts of films that I had overlooked or never seen or was in the theater for about 15 seconds, and I've had a home experience and go, wow, what an incredible film.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true, that the new forms of digital distribution that are out there, whether it's video, which is it's still a very chaotic scene, and it's not clear what's going to kind of come out as the main platform, but there's video on demand, all kinds of cable options, streaming options, and it's certainly true that for a lot of these smaller movies, foreign language films, art house films, you know, you used to, if you didn't live, and even if you did, in New York or Los Angeles or Chicago or a big city, you know, it might come and play for a couple weeks on an art film there, on an art house screen there. But if you weren't there, you'd have to wait. Maybe it would play for one night in a museum, or
if
maybe
you won a bunch of awards, it'll show up 9 months after release.
Right. Yeah. Or maybe never at all. But now, if you it's in your cable package or it's on your computer screen, and I think that a lot of people are finding these movies, and I think that there are some companies that are trying to figure out how to make this work as a business of distributing films. That's very encouraging.
So, with more ways to get a film out there, is it easier or more difficult to find an audience, you think?
Well, I think both. I think it's theoretically it's easier, and that's, you know, sort of always the promise.
But it seems
of the
like there's
internet.
More films today than ever.
Right. Well, there are more films than ever, partly because of these. One of the paradoxes that that I face in my job is that there are more movies opening in theaters than ever before. And that's partly because we at the New York Times only review movies if they open in theaters. And so one way to, the only way to get a review, even if you're primarily distributing your movie on, you know, VOD or online, if you can put it in a theater for a week, you get the sort of the free publicity bump. You get the review. You'll get noticed in the media. But it's the audience right now is overwhelmed with choices, not just of movies. It's not as if people only watch movies. There is television, and there's
HBO and all the cable companies that are coming up with their sort of limited series, sort of you know, very British sort of look at, you know, telling a big story.
Yeah, and television has I think, you know, finally blossomed as far as its artistic potential. So you have great stories. You have and people do tend week in and week out often to be more focused on and more excited about, you know, certainly the premiere of Mad Men on Sunday, or you know, the new season of Game of Thrones, or the recently concluded seasons of Walking Dead and Girls. I mean, those much more than movies a lot of times are what people are spending their time on and are talking about and are eager to see. So if you're a filmmaker trying to get noticed, you face an enormous challenge, because there's just more stuff out there, and how you sort through it and how it reaches you and how you learn about it can be very confusing. I think actually that's one of the reasons that critics do still matter, because finally, whether it's me or one of my colleagues or a website, you know, of like-minded folks, if you're looking for movies to see, if you're looking for what kind of interesting stories and images are out there, you might need a little help. You might need a little guidance. You might need something to sort of filter it and help you organize it. So I think that in that way, critics and criticism more broadly is kind of more important than ever.
Well, it certainly is. We enjoy reading your opinions in the New York Times. A.O. Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
It was great talking to you.
A.O. Scott is the chief film critic of the New York Times and our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be the guest of Congregation B'nai Emunah's Talking Heads event tonight at 7 o'clock at the synagogue. For more information on the event, visit TulsaGog.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The Oklahoma-Israel Exchange is pleased to present a concert performance by Sheshbash, an Arab-Jewish ensemble underscoring that music is a universal language. The concert is free and open to the public. It happens Wednesday night, April 10th at 7:30 p.m. in Christ Chapel on the ORU campus. Sheshbash embodies two cultures living together in harmony and seeking to find an elusive balance between East and West in music. For more information, 405-625-4519.